This podcast is sponsored by FHE Health and their Shatterproof program for first responders.
What makes Shatterproof a very unique program is it's one of the only programs in the country that first responders can go to that is 100% all first responders. Everybody's in pretty bad shape when they get here. And then 30 days later, when you can see the transformation and the difference in people when they've had 30 days of counseling, working with therapists, working with a psychiatrist, getting the neuro treatment, doing the breath therapy that's done here, the transformation that happens with the clients is really humbling to be able to work around and see, because people are getting better here. And it just shows that there's a need for the first responder community to deal with behavioral health issues and take them seriously and offer treatment to people that may need help out there. They should be afforded the ability to come get help when they need help. It has gotten better, but we still have a long way to go.
You are going to love my next guest. Clark Pennington has dedicated his entire career to his passion for public service in the field of law enforcement and education. He currently serves as the executive director of the First Responder Action Group, commonly known as FRAG. This is a veteran and first responder focused nonprofit whose hallmark program, Veterans Justice Initiative, trains and works side by side with law enforcement agencies to recognize veterans in crisis while avoiding the unnecessary criminalization of mental illness and substance abuse. This is really an amazing program, amazing show with a person, Clark Pennington, who's doing so much for the brave men and women who serve. Clark Pennington, next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here, host and creator of the Top Rank CJ Evolution podcast. Top Rank because of you, the listener and supporter. If you are new to the show, welcome. We know you're going to love it. Longtime listener, welcome back. And for those who are new, like and subscribe to this podcast, and please share with your family and friends. And special thanks to you, all the veterans out there, all the first responders, anybody working in the criminal justice field and veteran communities, thank you for what you do. It is a very tough environment. I don't have to tell you that, but remember this, you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the great work. On to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I have a great guest on the show, Clark Pennington. He is doing so much for so many people, mainly our first responder and community veterans. He is the executive director and chief operating officer of FRAG, and he's going to talk about it. And also, we're going to talk about the Independence Fund. Just, Clark, you're doing so much, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I guess retirement's not technically retirement anymore, is it?
Now, tell the listener, I mean, because we were just talking before we started, you, sir, have an amazing background, military, chief of police. I mean, you just have so much under your belt. Can you tell us a little bit about your backstory?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada. My entire focus was to get into law enforcement and really ultimately rise through the ranks and become a chief of police somewhere. But I've been blessed. I joined the military straight out of high school, served a little over 6 years. I was a military police officer there, just really wanted to get my feet wet in that environment and learn structure and organization and understanding of application of law, if you will. And then I was blessed when I got out of the military and joined a police department just outside of Baltimore, Washington area, which is a city called Frederick, Maryland. I was there for about 20 years, retired out. I was served in multiple different positions. I mean, from patrol officer, field training officer, motor officer. You know, I was an assistant supervisor, rose through the ranks, ultimately retired as a commander of our criminal investigations division, where, you know, ultimately the violent crimes, property
all the
crimes,
all the best stuff,
victim services. all the fun stuff, I guess, when you get into this job. Right. And then when I retired, I was a chief of police down here in North Carolina for about 5 years and finally realized it was time for me to retire from law enforcement. And the next step was, and I guess I didn't expect it to be along the same route as what I just got out of, which is really still training law enforcement officers. You know, back in Frederick, I was also a supervisor of our police academy. So I had a background in training, I had a background in developing classes. So that's what I'm still doing. And it's still a passion. And I think that's why I still love it.
Well, and you're giving back, like I've said before. What was the catalyst with it? Did you come from a military family, a first responder family, or what made you join the military right out of high school?
Yeah, so I come from a blended family. So my stepdad served in the United States Army. My grandfather on my dad's side, my real dad's side, was in the Navy. My stepdad's dad was in the Navy. So yeah, a lot of different military backgrounds. I actually am the fourth generation law enforcement officer out of my family. My great grandfather, my grandfather, and my dad were all constables and police officers up in Pennsylvania. So I don't know if it was just a raising and an understanding of service, what that looks like. And it was kind of instilled in me from an early childhood age that, you know, service is what matters. Making sure other people are safe while you're remaining safe yourself just kind of helped push me in this direction.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about FRAG, which is First Responders Action Group, in a minute. But what do you think of the state, Clark, of law enforcement right now? That's probably a broad question. But I still thank God that young men and women are getting into it. But it seems like there's not a lot of passion for it, you know, in the United States anymore, like when probably you and I got into it. I'm not saying, and that's not a dig on people who are pursuing law enforcement, but I guess when I was trying out for my first law enforcement job, there were hundreds, 500-600 people showing up for a testing. And when I was running tests as a commander in my last agency, there wouldn't be hardly anybody. I mean, what do you think of the state we're in right now? And more importantly, do you think it'll swing back? Because law enforcement is peaks and valleys. You know that.
Yeah, I guess, how do I look at it currently? I mean, it's obviously, you know, disheartening. It hurts, especially somebody like you, somebody like me, most of your listeners that really just believe in the mission of law enforcement, which is really that thin blue line between chaos and order, right? We are that individual that's kind of helping make sure that those individuals that need to be protected or want to be protected are protected. So, but I look at it this way, and I look at it as everybody that comes from our background, similar to you and I, it's our responsibility to continue to promote the good work that the men and women are doing out there on the street every single day, what they're enduring, what they're doing, and to continue to encourage the next generation to come up and to raise that hand and to take that oath and to stand up and say, who's going to step in? Send me. I'll be that guy. So I think that I take that mission very seriously. You know, I'm constantly promoting law enforcement. I think, you know, the men and women that are out there doing it, it's a much different world than it was, you know, 25 years ago, 28 years ago when I was first starting out. But, you know, it's our mission to continue to promote the good work that they do and to continue to push the ethics that goes into it, right? The opportunity that they're going to be presented with, you know, and I take that very seriously, and as I know you do.
Absolutely. And, you know, it has changed, obviously, but it kind of irritates me when I hear people, maybe, you know, from the generation of you and I, telling some young kid who's really excited about being a first responder, cop, fireman, then they're like, yeah, don't do that. It's like, why would you taint somebody that young just because you were maybe sent, not you, Clark, obviously, but, you know, just in general, because you're cynical and bitter and pissed off and no, foster that, you know, and try to develop that and give them, you know, some good tips and suggestions. Yeah. Because that's what we need.
We come from a culture too, right? I mean, military culture, law enforcement culture, first responder culture, it's a different culture than probably what you find in some of your other business cultures, right? If you go to IBM or you're working at, you know, Google, and some of those cultures are much different. So I think sometimes others hear our culture and don't quite understand. And when I was in the military, if you weren't complaining, you know, if you weren't complaining, you didn't care, right? A complaining soldier is a soldier that cares. A complaining officer or first responder means he cares. Why is he complaining? Because he wants to see change.
Yeah.
Right. So I think, you know, understanding that culture, and just because you hear somebody complain about the position or the job or the responsibilities doesn't necessarily mean that they're not committed to what they do. So I do think that that's important for us always to remember what we did and what they do out there every single day is an absolute critical mission and responsibility for this country to uphold our constitution, uphold our laws, and honestly to kind of take the values and norms of the society or the community that we work in and push those values and norms forward. So I think that's really mine. I'm not disagreeing with you. I don't like to see the kind of the transgression or the trends, you know, the movement that we've seen in law enforcement with some of the negativity coming from the media, the negativity coming from some of the community, all of these auditors that you're seeing on, you know, TikTok and Instagram and Facebook, you know, it's just disrespectful in and of itself, trying to gain rise from somebody, what they're complaining about of law enforcement that they think is law enforcement, they're doing themselves. So
yeah, absolutely.
Taking that high road, man, you know, just taking that high road and being a better person, a better police officer, and a better, you know, mission forward. So.
Absolutely. And I believe, and I'm sure you do, Clark, that I think the vast majority, maybe I'm just naive, but the vast majority of Americans out there support first responders, law enforcement. I wish they were more vocal, and they're not, because obviously they're afraid of retribution and all this other stuff. And I think a lot of it too is where you're at in the world. You know, in Florida, they're pretty pro law enforcement. And we're lucky down here. I'm not saying everybody loves the cops, but you know what I mean? They tend to lean more law enforcement friendly. I don't know about North Carolina, but I guess it's geographical too.
Oh my gosh. North Carolina is amazing for its police departments down here and its police officers. It's a big support. You know, I think the loudest voices you're going to hear is on both sides of the extreme, right?
Sure.
The loudest, and typically it's going to be the negative that rings out more. But, you know, the majority of the people in any community, I think, still supports law enforcement, still supports the mission, still understands the need for what we're doing and what they're empowering us to do, because we can't do what we do to police a city, a county, a state, without those state, city, or county members giving us the power to do it. So when we start to break that trust, that's when we start to see some of that power being removed. So it's in all of our responsibilities to continue to build that trust, build that unity with our communities.
Absolutely. Now let's pivot a little bit. Let's talk about FRAG, First Responders Action Group. What does it do? Tell a listener, why did you create this? I mean, you're the executive director, correct, sir?
I am, yeah. So to understand FRAG, you got to kind of understand how it came to be. And there's always a story behind every nonprofit, right? Because that's what really drives the passion and the mission behind it. So the Independence Fund, just to kind of back up a few years, the Independence Fund is a national nonprofit that serves our most catastrophically wounded veterans, their family members, their caregivers, and the allies that serve beside them shoulder to shoulder over in Afghanistan, typically looking at how are our catastrophically wounded veterans being treated, not only in our medical system, whether it be governmental or private practice, and advocating for them to ensure that they're getting the best care that they need. Well, in that, you know, fast forward a little bit, you know, Independence Fund's been around since 2007. It was born in the halls of Walter Reed, meaning that we saw a need in the Independence Fund back in 2007 to really bring these programs on mobility, providing them a level of independence that they lost, letting them get out in mobility chairs or track chairs that we provide for free.
2,600, a plug. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You've
provided Independence Fund
2,600 wheelchairs for our veterans out there. I'm sorry. I just needed to say that because that's amazing. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. So 2,600, and just to kind of paint a picture for your listeners, is 2,600 track all-terrain wheelchairs. We're talking about your state-of-the-art, you know, imagine a tank, and I hate to use that term, but imagine a tank and those tracks on there, right?
Yeah.
We're giving our veterans who maybe can't go hunting, can't go fishing, can't go on hikes with their families, can't go up trails because normal wheelchairs just will not navigate. We're providing this to them free of charge. We do it all through 100% donations that come in through either through our website or sending in to us into our location. But really, we are doing this 100% free. And all of that was born out of a observed need, lived experiences, not only by our CEO, who is Sarah Berardo. She's a national advocate for our military veterans. She has really propelled this organization to a position now that we are looked at in our national nonprofit arena as being the forefront experts when it comes to advocacy, when it comes to mobility, when it comes to programs. And we have one called Operation Resiliency, where we bring military veterans that deployed as a unit overseas in combat back together in the formation in which they deployed. Those units were starting to see suicidal ideations, loss of members coming back and dying by suicide. So all of those things, then providing them with an opportunity to become a tribe again, really lean on each other, right? And I can transition this into the military or into the law enforcement here in a second, but that's how our programs were all born. It's through real lived experiences through our CEO and other caregivers who understand what it's like to navigate that. Sarah's husband, you know, was catastrophically wounded in 2010, I believe, over in Afghanistan. He was hit by two separate improvised explosive device. The first one caused a traumatic brain injury. Jeez. The second one, he lost his leg, used much of his arm, and also a second traumatic brain injury. So she understands the need that goes into caring for these men and women. Mm-hmm. So with that, as I said, most of our programs and things are born out of real lived experiences.
Absolutely.
In 2021, Sarah was called by one of her husband's battle buddies, and he, you know, or actually his wife. And she said, listen, we'll call him John. John just packed up the RV with all of his guns, basically kissed me goodbye and said his see you laters or not see you laters. And she was afraid he was either going to get involved with a law enforcement officer and either John, we'll call him that, was going to be killed, or he was going to hurt and injure or kill a law enforcement officer. But she didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. This is the height of the pandemic. It's the height of all the negative press that's coming out against law enforcement.
Yeah.
She did not want to call the cops because she was afraid they might kill him. Sarah knew what needed to be done. She contacted one of our police departments in North Carolina and said, listen, this veteran gave the full story and said, what can you do? And I don't think this is an uncommon reaction, but the police officer on the other end of the phone said, ma'am, I'm going to take the missing persons report, but I'm just going to be honest with you. It's not illegal to kill yourself.
That's true.
You can imagine. Right. But that's really not the response that a caregiver, a loved one wants to hear about their loved one. No. They want to hear, we're going to do everything we possibly can to bring him home safe to you, right? So she realized that maybe law enforcement needed some additional training. So at around that time is when I came into contact with Sarah, and she asked me if I would be willing to take on this lofty goal of training law enforcement on military culture, on what does the traumatic brain injury look like? How does it manifest itself? How might a police officer come into contact with it out on the street? And then what are the reactions, or what should we be doing to hopefully decriminalize that mental health issue that veteran might be dealing with and connect them with resources? So not only are we saving law enforcement officers, you know, escalation of force, we're teaching them to de-escalate, but how do we move them to a place of action of safety on both sides?
Yeah.
And that's really how this thing began in 2021, started as a Veterans Justice Initiative under the Independence Fund. And just last year, we launched our standalone nonprofit. We're a 501c3 called the First Responders Action Group, where one of our key programs is our Veterans Justice Initiative.
That's awesome. My God, I mean, that's so much. I wish there were more organizations, nonprofit like yours, Clark. You guys go to your organization, I'm assuming, goes to departments, police departments, first responder agencies, and teaches the personnel on this, or how does it work?
Yeah, so we actually have a three-prong approach on how we run this entire program. One is training, which is what you're touching on now. We are funded currently by the state of North Carolina. You know, North Carolina, I told you, North Carolina loves their police officers. They love they love everything they're doing down here. They love their first responders, firefighters, EMS. And they said, listen, we see an absolute need to bring this level of training and awareness of not only resources, but, you know, impact to our police departments, sheriff's offices, state police, and EMS and firefighters. So they funded us in a pilot program in 2021 and said, let's see what you can do. So we went out and we started contacting all of our police departments in North Carolina and saying, here's what we're offering. Here's what we can do. We can bring real lived experiences to you, explain it, hopefully get a better understanding, and then reduce, hopefully, use of force and escalation issues. A couple of them really bought in. We started training them. We typically do in-person trainings. I'm not a big fan of online. I'm not going to lie to you. Online to me just feels very personal.
No. Yeah, it is. You can't get a lot. I mean, you can get, I think there's some benefits, like you said, to going online. But no, stuff like this great material needs to be in person.
Yeah. So we started taking it live to them, and we've trained, over 3,400 police officers in the state of North Carolina just on military culture, de-escalation tactics, and resource management for our veterans.
This sounds a lot like, or some like CIT, sir, which I'm familiar. I don't know if you're familiar with crisis intervention.
Of course.
But I think from what I'm hearing from you, amazing. This is much more in depth than CIT.
So we call it veterans crisis intervention, right? So we call it veterans crisis intervention training. It is really kind of an expounding on our crisis intervention training. I'm CIT certified. I'm through the training, done the practice, you know, all of that. So it does have a basis under that, right? We're dealing with mental health crisis. We're dealing with somebody who is in crisis, who may not be operating in a rational brain, how to get them out of maybe that lizard brain mentality, or they're not thinking rationally, back into a rational thought process, so we can de-escalate them and then ultimately get them into treatment. So it is a crisis intervention process.
Yeah. And I think it just, when you're talking, it just reminded me of when I first started in law enforcement. I don't know if this was like, if it was like this for you, Clark, is that we weren't running on a lot of mental health crisis calls. You know, we weren't, but it, towards the end of, before I retired, these officers were going to them all the time. You know, I mean, people in crisis, mental health challenges, addiction, both. And it just seems to be getting more and more of like a normal thing in most agencies, where they're going to multiple calls for service with people in crisis, mental health crisis.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know that we, thinking back on my career, early in my career, thinking about what mental health crisis looked like. Mm-hmm. Maybe we were dealing with mental health crisis, but we weren't categorizing it as that.
Yeah, I'm sure we were. Yeah.
And there's such, we weren't treating it like it should have been treated, right? What we talk about in some of our training is what we might have done in the past, which is, you know, cops have a couple of different options when they get out on the call for service for somebody who's in crisis. They're irate, they're upset, they can't, you know, they're using anger to try to control a situation. We have to think of two options. We either arrest them, or we look for an opportunity to do an involuntary commitment, or in Maryland, we called it an emergency petition. Take them to the hospital. If we can determine that they're a danger to themselves or to others, then we can take them to the hospital. Other than that, we were really just, if you couldn't do one of the two, you walked away, waited for the next call for service. Or you, I remember early in my career hearing many times, hey, if I got to come back here tonight, somebody's going to jail, because that was our response.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is get out of that mentality and start to think about there's other options, especially if you're dealing with a veteran crisis. The veteran, the VA, and our community care partners, there are so many resources available to a veteran in crisis that maybe aren't available to regular Joe Schmo on the street, somebody who has not served in the military, who has not been through those critical situations. So we're trying to get the law enforcement officer to stop thinking arrest or EP, initially start thinking, let's decriminalize this mental health crisis issue and get them into some level of treatment. And that's Absolutely. What FRAG does. That's our second part of our three-pillar approach. We are case managers. So if a police department in Fayetteville, North Carolina, true example, gives us a call and says, hey, you know, we've got a guy that lives in our community who, you know, has been screaming on his front porch. He's been irate. He's been yelling at his neighbors. You know, we've gone out and we've told him he can't do this, but we know he's a veteran, and we know he's just not thinking through the problem solving process adequately to manage his own actions. So they gave us a call. Our case managers will go out. We're not crisis response. We'll go afterwards. We knock on the door. We try to talk to him. We build a rapport with them as a veteran. I don't tell them I'm a cop, but I'm a prior veteran, talking to them about it, and then hopefully guiding them into some level of treatment so that we can reduce calls for service for our police departments, reduce encounters with police departments while they're in crisis, so that hopefully they don't have those continued crisis processes, and then there's less opportunity to criminalize what's truly happening to them, which is deep down mental health.
Yeah, and then throwing them in jail. I mean, you know, Clark, some people need to be in jail, but you know, putting people in jail because they're in a mental health crisis does nothing. If anything, it burdens the, you know, the correctional system when they should be getting alternate help. You know, I mean, but it's a culture thing. So when attendees go, you know, to your training, sir, your organization's training, are they mostly line cops, or is there command staff there? Because, you know, as well as I do, this is a cultural thing too. So if the young cop on the street is given the option, arrest or walk away or, you know, or do something else, put them on an M1. We called it M1 in Colorado.
Yeah.
It needs to start at the leadership level and then filter it its way down. So hopefully command staff are doing these trainings too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you an example. Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, absolutely amazing organization down here. It's on the shore of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We did a training for their entire police department. We're talking line officers, detectives, all command staff, their dispatchers, right? Because the dispatcher should be able to ask the question, and we talk about asking the question, have you served the United States Armed Forces? Because when you ask somebody, are you a veteran, you may not get the right response. Mm-hmm. If somebody didn't serve in wartime, somebody served in reserves and maybe did, you know, a couple of, you know, 2-week deployments or 2-week activations, they may not consider themselves veterans. They are. But we don't ask that question because we don't want to mislead that. So we're teaching law enforcement officers, firefighters. We have firefighters in the class with us too from certain counties about the questions to ask how to start building rapport, understanding terminology, and then ultimately building that not friendship, but that opportunity to kind of understand each other, empathy, and then work towards a solution. But something you said earlier, if you don't mind, can I
jump
on?
Go ahead, sir. Go ahead, sir.
You know, I'm a cop. I've been a cop my entire life. So I know people need to go to jail, right? There are certain individuals that are inherently evil, and we have got to make those arrests.
Absolutely.
I don't fault a police officer who puts handcuffs on a guy that needs to go. I had an old chief that used to tell me, you know, community policing and arrests are not mutually exclusive. Sometimes to effectively community police or police a community effectively, we have to make some arrests. But what I think, like you said, is we're looking to change culture. It starts
Absolutely.
At the top. It starts at our chiefs, our sheriffs, our commanders, our sergeants, who start to say, listen, I get you're maybe looking for a stat, right? Or an arrest stat, or how many arrests did you get in the course of your career? How many people did you help during the course of your career?
Absolutely.
How many people? Start looking at the victims that maybe you were able to intercede for. But how many veterans, how many people did you see that were in crisis that maybe didn't need to go to jail? Because what we see and what we know through studies in the VA and the DOD is, you know, there are certain things that trigger suicidal ideations, one being isolation. Well, what is jail? Isolation. So you're starting to somebody who's in crisis, isolate them further. If they don't need to be there, you may be pushing them further down that crisis process.
Absolutely.
Or what about loss of integrity, loss of honor, loss of a family, loss of their job? All of those are triggers that may push somebody who's in crisis into further crisis and further suicidal ideation. So we just talk about that with law enforcement and say, you have options. You know, you have the opportunity to make a decision, a problem-solving decision on the street. Solve the problem, but look for the root cause. If
Absolutely.
The root cause is mental health, let's deal with the mental health. If the root cause is inherent evilness and they need to go to jail, then deal with the inherent evilness. So just problem solve as you would a traffic accident location, problem solve people.
Absolutely. And for the young cop out there listening, going, oh, they just don't want me to do my job. No, that's not the case.
That's not it.
But part of your job is to educate people too
yeah.
and help them. You're the expert. People are looking at you. First cop on scene. To de-escalate. Sometimes you have to escalate, but I used to get out of more trouble with my mouth and talking people down than I did the opposite. I can use force, Chief. You know that. But
yeah,
I would rather talk my way out of it and try to de-escalate and help somebody than go hands-on.
Absolutely. And that's really the message we're trying to talk about is problem solving, right? There's been so many problem solving models, the POP model, all the different you know, COPS COPS has a different manuals you can get on problem solving. Every one of them says, look for the root cause. What's the reason that something is happening? What's the reason traffic accidents are happening in this intersection?
Absolutely.
Well, you can go sit a motorcycle out there and write 50 tickets in an hour. Congratulations.
That's not solving the problem.
Right. The problem's still there. Just look at it the same concept when you're dealing with somebody in crisis, right?
Yeah.
So that's all we're asking. You know, absolutely, man. If you got to put handcuffs on somebody, sometimes you just got to do it.
Absolutely. Now, what about the after action, Clark? So you go into an organization. I would love to see, I mean, I imagine after you get done, use of force goes down, complaints. You know, deadly force maybe. I don't know. You tell me. I mean, after they get this amazing training from your organization, I imagine some things are changing for the good.
Yeah, that's part of our call to action to a lot of our police departments. So, we track data on so many different levels, right? As
sure.
a police department, you track traffic accidents, you track drug arrests, you track, you know, complaints within a certain area. You look for repeat offenders, those individuals that are constantly being called. And how do we deal with that repeat offender? But what we're not doing is capturing data on the number of veterans that we're interacting with on a daily basis. And I think, you know, we can sit here and say there's a problem, but until we can show data and actually prove there's a problem, that's what we're asking a lot of our law enforcement community partners to do, is to really start tracking that data. So really, when we start talking about veteran issues, you can translate that over into CIT for anybody's issue. How do you de-escalate? But what's different in our approach to really de-escalating veterans is two things. There's two different issues. One is when you're dealing with a veteran who has been trained equally as you have in hand-to-hand combat, in deadly force encounters, in less lethal combat, all of those things, you're dealing with somebody equally trained as you. So if you can identify that veteran early on in the encounter and understand that that person is probably as equally as trained as you, my first response is going to be, well, I really don't want to go hands-on with this guy because either he's going to get hurt or I'm going to get hurt. So it changes your mentality, right? So that's one thing we look at. The second thing that we really try to push to our law enforcement officers is our trainings are all similar. what I just talked about. They're also similar in the way we approach problems. Anger and aggression is a tool used in the military. And I'll go back to an old movie. It's called Full Metal Jacket. Remember, show me your war face. What was the reason behind that exercise? Get the individual so angry and hyped up that he then controls that situation and ultimately wins the encounter. We're training our law enforcement a lot in a similar way. When they get into an encounter, you have to win at all costs, right? That's, you have to go home at the end of the night. We've heard that 150 times. Well, if a police officer can understand that if he's using anger and aggression to try to control a veteran or somebody who served in the military, their initial response is anger and aggression in return. So somebody has to be the rational brain. Somebody's got to identify, this guy's a veteran, anger and aggression is not going to really be the best bet here. So how do I de-escalate and get this person to a problem-solving process? So really just keeping those things in mind, reminding it, when your partner's behind you or next to you, his job's to watch your back, not only physically, but also career-wise, right? He needs to make sure you don't make a mistake that's going to cost you your career, and you don't make a mistake that's going to get you or somebody else hurt. This is a way that we train the entire organization to be that battle buddy, to be that partner, that contact and that cover that says, hey, man, maybe take it down a notch. It might work better with this guy who served in the military. Yeah. So it's just really bringing the entire concept home.
Amazing stuff. I mean, so when you do the training, Clark, I mean, how is it, like a 2 or 3 day thing, and how many hours is it? And last question I have, I'm assuming it's like post-certified. The state recognizes this as towards your, I don't know if they call it post.
It's similar concept.
Yeah. Similar concept where it goes towards your peace officer training hours for the year.
Yeah. So each state is different, as you know. So North Carolina has a training and standards. Out of our area, we call it training and standards. Training and standards tracks all of our CEUs or credits to continue your certification. In North Carolina, it's much different than Maryland, but in North Carolina, for example, the chief gets to do what they call chief select or chief options. And we talk to the chiefs and we say, make us one of your chief options, report it to the state. They already know that we're here. They're already accepting our training. It's 3.5 hours for basic. And then they get those credits, right?
Sure.
In Maryland, for example, we just trained a police department outside of Baltimore, Maryland. It's called the University of Maryland at Baltimore. They're actually inside the city of Baltimore. We applied for a post certification there. There it's called MPCTC, which is Maryland Police Corrections Training Center or Commission. They actually gave us a post certification, what they call a P number, and everybody went to that class. So each state that we go to, it's been developed not only by myself, but by a chief clinician. Who has been retired military. He also works in suicide prevention for law enforcement. Everything we do has been reviewed by our chief clinician.
So if a listener, Clark, listens to this and says, I want Bragg to come and talk to my organization, and they're in Colorado, they can reach out to you and you can come out there, and that would just correct. And that would just be a simple matter of Colorado would recognize it as training or what?
Yeah, so we would do the research on each state to determine what the post requires. I'm a state certified in Maryland, state certified in North Carolina. We have different state certified. As I said, most of the people that work for me are previous cops and trainers, so they understand the culture. So we would do the research. I will tell you this, though. North Carolina funds all of North Carolina training. What we do outside of the state of North Carolina is either through donations, which we do have some organizations.
That's going to be my next
great
question.
and we can touch on that in a sec. But like our travel costs, we don't charge. We don't make money off of this. Some of our travel costs outside of our responsibilities in North Carolina would be covered by either donation or sometimes the agency would ask us to come in.
Amazing. I mean, it's just such needed work out there. And I'm so glad that Frag and you're doing this in your organization, sir. And you were going to touch about donations and that aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to touch on it in this perspective. We have a lot of great community partners out there. Mm-hmm. You know, one of our community partners who if you have heard him on a couple of podcasts, Tim Kennedy, who is amazing man. Absolutely. You know, advocate for law enforcement. He's an advocate for military. He's an advocate for this mental health. Has sat on a couple of our targeting a solution panels at the Independence Fund and really has seen this program work, has seen what we do for not only law enforcement, but for also his veteran brothers and people that have gotten into crisis. So he's a great partner. You know, we've had other organizations and companies that have stepped up and really clothing companies that have said, hey, can we support your mission? That's can we present part of our sale? One in particular I just got called on just yesterday was Black Sheep Cartel, a brand new clothing company out of California. They like provided
that,
us with our
like that name, Black Sheep.
Yeah. Yeah, they presented us with a check of their first sale.
That is amazing.
And that's just not, those are just two, you know, we've got so many different companies out there that have reached out to us, you know, we were at SHOT Show this year and just people stopping in saying, hey, how can we get involved? You know, there's other aspects and I don't know how much time you want to go into it, but we reach out to some of our catastrophically wounded police officers. We have a police officer who retired out of Las Vegas, Nevada, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, who got paralyzed in a motorcycle accident. Just like our military brothers, he's unable to navigate and feel a level of independence to help around the house. We raised money to present him with a track chair. Similarly, we did. We're giving those to law enforcement officers now because we know there's a need to continue that level of service, that continue that level of independence. And a lot of our donations, we are earmarking to serve some of our catastrophically wounded police officers.
And see, this gives me hope, man. Not that I didn't have hope before, Clark, but yeah. when I hear somebody like you come on the show and talk about your great organization, and for the listener out there who's listening, there are people out there, many, 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 many people, more than you know, that care about you, care about the job you're doing. And Frag and Clark and his organization are living proof of that. I mean, you know, to help so many people and, you know, just really not get much in return. You're just giving back, which is the name of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Service to us is what matters. I mean, I've been serving my entire life and yeah. I can't imagine not serving. So if they are interested in supporting us, I mean, fragheroes.org is a way you can go check out our website. The Independence Fund or independencefund.org is another link that will take you in. We're sister organizations and we work hand in hand in things that need to be done. So check us out. If you're interested, give me a call. We can always have a conversation and see what might work out for your organization.
And I imagine your organization just keeps growing and growing, correct?
It does. Yeah. It's, you know, I had a board meeting tonight with we're a nonprofit, so we're governed by a board and just reporting out some of the things that are happening and some of the growth and the requests do come in. And if we're able to accommodate them, we do. We were just in Indiana a couple of weeks ago presenting our program there. Maryland's interested in expanding what we're doing down here in North Carolina.
I'd love to bring you down. I'd love to bring you down to Florida, sir.
You know, I'm not going to lie. That's part of the conversation. I think every state that has a desire to serve their police officers and has a desire to serve their veteran population should really be looking at the ways to de-escalate and to use diversion programs to serve that population.
Absolutely. Clark Pennington, thank you so much, sir, for your service to this country, service to the law enforcement community. God bless you. Everything we talk about is going to be linked up in the show notes for the listener. Sir, if I can help you in any way, please, you got my contact information. Please reach out to me. Thank you for being on.
Thanks, sir. We'll be in contact.
All right.